Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. There are some places known for a distinctive kind of architecture. The historic skyscrapers of Chicago and New York City, the sprawling opulent mansions of Newport, Rhode Island, or the grand Victorian detailing adorning the buildings that dot the hilly streets of San Francisco. And while Vermont is more often thought of in terms of its natural beauty, from the intimately close surroundings of the Green Mountains to the great expanse of Lake Champlain and the winding rivers and brooks that run through its towns and villages, there is great architecture to admire here as well. Tourists flock to Vermont to snap pictures of historic covered bridges and round barns. There are one-room schoolhouses, classic white steeple churches, and of course, the Golden Dome gleaming atop the smallest capital city in America. Those examples are easy to find, but for folks who study the structures we make, there is a lot more in Vermont to explore and discover, and that's just what we're going to do today with two of our guests. Joining me in our VPR studios in Colchester, Devin Coleman is the state architectural historian for the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation. Devin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us as well is Britta Ton, an architectural historian and preservation planner at the engineering and design firm VHB in South Burlington. Britta, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
So, Devin Coleman, let me start with you as the architectural historian. Is there a classic, maybe even not so classic, style that could be used to describe Vermont's buildings from its earliest days as a state?
I would say if we, you know, go back to statehood, 1791, certainly there were buildings being built before that, the colonial period and so on. But if we start in the 1790s, the federal style would really be our starting point. And that was really the first major architectural style that took root in Vermont.
How would you describe that federal style?
Characterized by very light and delicate detailing and symmetry. It's based on classical architecture. And it's typically, you know, your typical federal house will be broadside to the road, so the eaves of the roof alongside the road, paralleling the road. And within that broad face of the building, you'll have, if it's a two-story building, five windows across the top, four windows across the bottom, with a door right in the middle.
So I'm very specific about that.
Yes, five over four with a door.
It's like a haiku. You know, yes. You got to have five yes. Before.
And, you know, very regular, very proportioned. You know, everything is detailed in relation to the other elements of the building. So very highly stylized.
Well, architecture, you know, does seem to be linked always to economic shifts, transformational innovations throughout history. How did Vermont's architecture change, for example, once the railroads were built to connect people throughout the country?
The railroads were pivotal in terms of opening Vermont up to increase trade and wealth and building materials and ideas. So suddenly with the railroad, information could travel quickly as well as physical building materials. So you start to see mass production of building details, patterned shingles and turned porch posts that are maybe made in a different state. And then they can be put on a flatbed and brought to Vermont and put on a house in Burlington.
Stuff they couldn't get before here.
Right.
Were those new things embraced, though, in Vermont, as far as you know?
Very much. Yeah, Vermont, there's definitely a history of Vermonters, like anyone else, they want to show that they're current and they know what's going on in the world. And one of my favorite things is being out in rural Vermont and coming across a little farmhouse, maybe a cape, you know, built 1810. Yeah. And it has a Gothic Revival wall dormer, probably put on in the 1850s. And then there's a Queen Anne-style front porch from the 1890s. And those farmers, they wanted to show that they knew what was popular and current, just like we do today.
Amazing. Britta Ton, what about the architectural landscape as we move along a little bit and styles that may be a little more familiar to listeners, like Art Deco, let's say, in the 1920s, or the modernist movement that started after World War II? Did those styles also get reflected in Vermont architecture?
Absolutely. And I think when people think of Vermont, they're not thinking about those modernist styles as much. You know, I think you know, picture that everyone has in their head is the Vermont countryside with an English-style barn from 1830 and a farmhouse, a quaint vernacular farmhouse.
Right.
But Vermont had some very prosperous urban centers, and those were typically where we see this embracing of more modernist forms arrive. 1920s, 1930s sees the Art Deco movement take off, and that originates in some of the larger cities, New York, for example, but migrates north. And many times these were built for theaters where they wanted to start broadcasting some of the earliest talkies, the movies. So the Flynn Theater, for example, built in 1930 to start screening talkies.
And that was an Art Deco style.
That's an Art Deco style building in Burlington. The Latches Theater in Brattleboro. And then there's a service building in Rutland, which is really interesting. It was Vermont's skyscraper at the time, seven stories tall, the largest building when it was built.
Seems like an oxymoron, but...
Yeah, but really they were drawing upon some of the skyscraper forms that you saw in New York City, for example, you know, the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building. And it was built right at the start of the Depression as a service to the Rutland community to really bolster commerce. And that's why it was called the Service Building.
What about the modernist movement of the 1950s, I guess, you know, after World War II? I mean, how would you describe that?
Devin, do you want to talk more about modernism?
Sure.
Devin has some really
seminal research.
Done a lot of research on that.
What I find so exciting about the modernist movement is just that whole era, the post-World War II period, when we've won the war, we're on top of the world, there's economic prosperity, mass production, everyone's buying a car, they're traveling, you know, the classic single-family home with a front yard and a backyard and a washing machine and TVs and...
White picket fences and
exactly,
the whole thing.
This explosion of American culture, and it's reflected in the architecture, in two, you know, what may seem like divergent ways. Some of the buildings start to look back. So we see a lot of colonial revival, little single family homes that look like Cape Cod houses. And there's another thread that looks forward and says, we're done with history. We're going to design modern buildings that reflect our modern lives. And we see very streamlined, you know, flat roofs, minimal ornamentation, a rejection of historical styles. And I think both are valid architectural expressions for that period.
Our producer, Matthew Smith, has put some laptops in front of us, and I hope we're both looking at the same thing here. You guys are across the table from me, but we got a picture up here. I think it's Merchants Row in Rutland. Are you guys both looking at that? All right. So sort of describe what we're looking at there. Britta, let's start with you and tell us a little bit about what this style shows us, Merchants Row here in Rutland.
Okay. Yeah. So this is the service building in the center there, towering above everything else in Rutland. So really tall when it was built. What we see is the use of vertical elements. So these sort of, you know, these it's arranged in sort of a tripartite way, we say. So it has three parts to the main facade there. And these spandrels in between the windows on each floor. So lots of glass, though, but interspersed with brick. And what's interesting is the facade is really, you know, this detail is just on the main facade and wraps just a little bit around the corners where you might be able to see it from the street. But beyond that, it's just actually a plain brick building. So this was a way to add, you know, some sort of interesting element to your building, make it look really contemporary, but without breaking the bank.
And this, of course, a little bit of flair.
A little bit of flair. Yeah. This was the Depression era, so they didn't want to go too all out there. And then you see that tower in the center sort of projecting up and adding to the height of the building.
This is so interesting because it's forcing me to look at buildings in a way that I didn't before. And I think that's part of the wonder of architecture, isn't it? I mean, you guys, this is what you do. You both know this world so well. But if we can all get to look at the buildings around us in a different way and realize that a lot of thought went into most of these. Not all, but a lot of thought really did. Is that something that people forget about with architecture sometimes?
Absolutely. And I think I would really encourage people to try to move beyond that initial gut reaction of, I like it, I don't like it. You know, that's
I have to admit, that's what I do when I see a building.
Very subjective analysis. And start asking questions about, okay, that doesn't look quite you know, I don't really like that. Why?
Yeah,
you know, what is it about that building? Is it the form? Is it the material? Is it the color? Because there's so much more to any building. These buildings don't appear out of nowhere. They are designed and built for a purpose. And if you can get beyond the like-dislike subjectivity and really start asking those questions about why does it look the way it does? What was the intent? What was the context? What constraints did the builder have? Then you can start to really appreciate the architecture.
A lot of interest there. We are getting a lot of questions. People are coming in with their own recommendations for things too, and I'm going to be asking you guys for some of those in just a moment. But I'll read this first comment from Robert Foot Shannon, president of the Fourth Corner Foundation, who said, "The Fourth Corner Foundation in Wyndham has architecture of three buildings that are highly sustainable, built over 48 years. We'll post a link to that picture of that at vpr.org. And we got folks calling in, so let's go to the phones. Tom is on the line in Moncton. Hi, Tom.
Yeah. A few years ago, my wife and I were having dinner in Burlington in a restaurant, and the restaurant happened to have a cat, a neighborhood cat, that came to visit. And another couple sitting nearby, you know, we thought that was kind of unique. We got to talk about the cat, and it turned out, I think the lady was a professor or was teaching at one of the colleges, and they were looking for a house, and the gentleman said, you have pretty unique architecture. And I never thought of Vermont as having an architecture. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you have all your garages on the front of your houses, the doors facing towards the road. I go, yeah. And he goes, well, in South Africa, we put those things in the rear out of sight. You know, why do you have your garages on the front?
Why do we have those garages on the front? Okay, that's a fair question. Anybody want to tackle that one?
Sure. I think that has a lot to do with urban planning. And most of Vermont's communities didn't develop with strict street grids and alleys. And it's in communities where they've laid it out before development with alleyways to service those garages where you see them in the back. Whereas in Vermont, a lot of, you know, in Burlington in the hill section, those houses were built before people had cars, and so they had carriage houses or small wagon sheds, and then those would get replaced with a garage later on that simply, due to the street grid, had to face the street.
Practical reasons there. We got this question from Judy in South Elburg, who's asking, I've noticed many small square brick homes, sometimes with dates from the 1840s. What are these? Where was the brick made? Does anybody have an idea about that?
There is a great collection of those houses around the Plainfield area, Washington County, and it would all be locally made brick. Brick being something that if you had a good clay supply on a riverbank, a brick maker could set up a small kiln and fire the bricks right on site, because brick is very heavy. It's not something that you, you know, you don't produce it in St. Johnsbury and truck it to Windsor.
Yeah, it's you better
brick,
think about it
brick
first.
Is made local. So, so those would be early Cape Cod style, maybe classic cottage style houses from the 1830s, 1840s.
Britton, let me ask you if you have any, like if you had to show somebody one underrated or underappreciated gem in Vermont that's just one of your favorites, what would it be?
Oh, that's a great question. I have to say, this might sound a little funny, but I'm really partial to ski lodges right now, and they're not what people necessarily think of as historic buildings. A ski lodge is, you know, used so much today. I'm not sure that everyone experiences them very positively, some of these older ones, because they tend to be smaller, a little more cramped. They get stinky in the winter. But I really love the base box at Mad River Glen that's designed in the 1940s. It is south-facing with huge banks of windows to take advantage of solar energy to warm the inside of the lodge. And, you know, the connection between ski lodges and the arrival of modernism and the dissemination of modernism around the state is a really, really interesting topic to explore. These ski developers at the time were really looking towards modernism as a way to draw people in. It was seen as very contemporary, but also very functional for a ski lodge. You could create a big open space, lots of banks of windows, lots of rustic wooden materials that were exposed to kind of relate to the rural setting that they were a part of. So I really love ski lodges, and I encourage people to really look more carefully at some of the older ones. You can see that clearly have some elements of modernism, which I just described, and maybe appreciate them for what they are.
We're looking now at another guy. We're going back to our laptops here. Someone named Jim sent in a picture of a building. I have no idea what this is. I don't know what we're looking at here, but I'd love for one of you to try to describe what this is, whether you're familiar with the exact building or not.
Yeah, I have not seen the building. I think it's the New England Center for Circus Arts down in Brattleboro, if I'm not mistaken.
Hold that thought 1 second, Devin, because we actually have Jim on the line right now with us. Jim, hi, you're on Vermont Edition. We're taking a look at your photo. You're calling from Brattleboro. What are we looking at here?
Well, I actually didn't send in a photo, but I am calling about the New England Center for Circus Arts. It's a building that was opened 2 years ago, and it's the only custom-made trapezium in the United States. And you were talking about how a lot of thought has to go into architecture. And this is a building that, when you're designing it, you're not only looking at snow loads and wind loads and everything else and trying to make it aesthetically pleasing, but you also have all the dynamic and static loads, because all these trapezists and performers are hanging from the ceiling. So there was a tremendous amount of thought that had to go into the design and building of, you know, to try to fit into Vermont, but also be a world-class building.
And we're talking about the New England Center for Circus Arts. I want to make that clear. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, and where is that located, Jim?
It's on Town Crier Drive. It's right in Brattleboro, right in the town of Brattleboro off Putney Road.
Okay, I think that is the picture, whether you sent it in or not, that we're taking a look at here, and that is a very interesting building indeed. Jim, thank you very much for the call. Let's get right back to the phones. We have a caller. It looks like it's Michael in Hinesburg. Hi, Michael. You're on Vermont Edition.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm calling in regards to, well, I have a question. I grew up in a house, probably one of the oldest houses in Chittenden County. It was finished in 1790. You know, it doesn't have a bit of metal in any of the original frame. It's a beautiful structure. Mm. I'm wondering, the people who built that house, it was a guy who moved up from Connecticut, and he started a mill over in Chilliwack somewhere. I'm wondering, is the people who built that house, did they live there? Were they itinerant builders? Did they, you know, how did that work if you had a big project like that and transportation wasn't like it is now? Did they live there? How did it go?
Interesting question, Michael. Thank you for the call. Which of you like to tackle that one first?
Well, I can take a stab at it. Yeah. I would say certainly there were local builders, and it's not uncommon to be in a region of the state, and if you can get a good look at the frame of a building, you start to see little characteristics of how that particular person handled the mortise and tenon joinery, or laid out the frame and proportions and sizes. But on the other hand, I also think there was, amongst early settlers, a general knowledge of building skills to the point where they could certainly help out with that local builder and maybe finish off the structure once the frame was built. It was definitely a group effort. There was a tremendous amount of labor goes into cutting down the trees and hewing the logs and building that frame.
We got this question from our colleague here at VPR, Leslie. And, you know, Devin, you may have answered this one already, but she's asking, I see a lot of older houses with curved glass windows, and I've heard it's somewhat unique to Vermont. Why are there so many houses with flat roofs in Burlington? And I think you were talking before about the modernism moving in.
Right. Modernism, certainly with that rejection of historical styles, a gable roof was too old-fashioned looking. So they went with the flat roofs. And you do see that in more urban areas. Where,
but doesn't that sort of collect the snow? I mean, you know, from practical reasons, it doesn't seem all that practical.
Yeah, a lot of it depends on the detailing and how well the roof is built and sealed. Certainly a lot of them did fail. there's no question. And very few are actually perfectly flat. Most are more of a shed roof that do shed off some of the rain and snow.
Rich is on the line from Woodstock. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi, how are we doing?
We're doing well. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
So I'm wondering, as the state became deforested in the 19th century, where did we get our wood to build what we have today?
I'll take that. Most of it was imported from Canada. So what we see beginning in the 1850s is that most of Vermont is deforested. So we no longer have access to those local building materials. Specifically in Burlington, there were a group of sort of lumber barons that sort of formed a really, really successful import business. So importing raw lumber from Canada and floating it down the Chambly Canal, which was in part along the Richelieu River as well down into Lake Champlain. And that really opened up all the Canadian timber. It was turned and processed in the mills in Burlington and then shipped out throughout the state and actually throughout New England too. So by the 1870s, Burlington is the third largest lumber industry in the whole country behind Albany and Chicago. But then, of course, you know, as you know, the 1890s and the West opens up with the expansion of the railroads, suddenly we're able to import lumber from the really huge trees that are out west. And that sort of kills the lumber industry in Burlington. It's cheaper to get domestic lumber.
Britta, that raises a question in my mind when you were mentioning about Canadian lumber coming in. Were there any trading of influences, given that Vermont is so close to, you know, Canada? Were any kind of influences back and forth on the architecture there that we know of?
It's certainly within the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. There are some great examples in Winooski and Burlington of French-Canadian congregations and French-Canadian architects, pastors designing buildings that are very strongly influenced by Canadian architecture.
But I have to say, I was always surprised that there's maybe not more domestic architecture that is influenced by what you might see in Montreal. Think of the row houses. But it really was mostly a product of the Catholic Church.
I'm going to ask you to both take a look at your laptop in front of you there as we get this comment question from Greg in Burlington, who emailed a photo of his home to us. We're taking a look at it right there. I've told folks that our 1898 home in Burlington's Hill section is an example of a builder inspired by the Richardsonian redstone, with the first story extended up from the foundation and wooden shingled upper stories, probably to save money, writes Greg. Builders substituted clapboard for the first floor masonry above the redstone foundation. This is all speculation on my part, says Greg. Have I been talking through my hat?
I would say, you know, we're looking at a house with an asymmetrical roof line. It's a little hard to figure out from this angle. Wood clapboards and early 20th century, if it, you know, some colonial revival inspired. But also that asymmetry speaks back a little bit to the Queen Anne style. So I'd say this is kind of a transitional style building. And that's a good point, is that very few buildings, we get hung up on styles and yeah. We like to categorize and put everything into a slot. Very few buildings are actually picture perfect, spot on examples of a style.
Right.
Most blend and merge and take a little of this and a little of that, and then they get added on to 50 years later, and that's what makes it interesting.
Can I say, and again, I'm a total amateur here, I love this asymmetrical style, like the house we're looking at with Greg's. I just find it so much more interesting to look at. And, you know, other parts of the country, I guess maybe sometimes you go out to California, you can see rows and rows of very similar houses. They're all flat. They're all ranches or whatever. Britta, what do you feel about like sort of that asymmetrical style? Is it just more fun to look at in some ways?
I think that was really a lot of the intention of this, what we call a more picturesque aesthetic, as opposed to the stricter versions of classicism when Devin described the federal style house. It's very restrained, very symmetrical, like don't want to, you know, really think outside the box, literal box too much. but the Victorian era, and this is the late 19th century, is all about exploring these kind of interesting facade and putting ornamentation on the facade. And it's not always looking united. Like there's not one type of material throughout that kind of ties it all together. And you have colored glass in the windows, you have shingles that are patterned, you have all sorts of applications, wood trim. So I think for a lot of people, it was very much a reaction against the sort of restraint that we saw with classicism.
But Britta, this is Vermont. This is New England. This is the very stiff, you know, we have a very strict style here. Does this sort of go against that image we have of New England and Vermont of being so kind of stuffy in a way? Or
it might, to an extent, yeah. Although this, you know, the Victorian style sort of overtook everywhere in the country in the late 19th century. So really, I mean, we see it a lot in some of the more urban centers because it was made, you know, it was enabled by access to lumber that Devin mentioned was coming up on the train and all of these kind of stock or mass produced architectural details that could be applied to a house. So it was just all the rage all over the country, even in Vermont.
Even in Vermont. John is on the line from Montpelier. Hi, John. You're on Vermont Edition.
Hi. I'm calling because one of your previous callers had asked about the shortage of lumber in the 19th century. And I live in an old house that was built in the late 1860s. And I was told it's called a balloon frame because they would use standard post and beam. But due to the lack of large lumber, they would build two small frames, one inside the other. And I was wondering if you could speak on that.
Yes, the balloon frame was an early form of construction, of wall construction. And it's more has to do with the use of what we call stick lumber, which is mass-produced milled lumber. If you have a two-story house, the studs, which form the walls, run from the foundation all the way up to the eave of the second floor. Hmm. And this was a new technique that used, for one thing, it was much easier to build. And you didn't have to know how to hand carve mortise and tenons in a timber frame. But they were derided because they looked so lightweight. They looked like balloons. That's where the balloon frame term comes from, is this smaller lumber, pieces of lumber, but more of them, creating the frame of the house.
That's interesting. I do want to fit in another caller here. Sam is on the line from Rutland. Hi, Sam.
Hi. Thanks for having me and for the discussion. Appreciate
sure.
it.
You bet.
Yeah. So I just have want to see if you have any comments about the Wilson Castle in Proctor. I believe, you know, on the topic of local materials and a mix of building styles, I believe that it was built using like English brick and French marble and imported materials from Europe shortly after the emergence of the railroad in Vermont. So I'll take it off the air, but any comments about the castle would be great.
Well, thanks very much, Sam. You guys familiar with this castle? How big is it? And what are we talking about here?
It's certainly an anomaly. This is not your typical Vermont building.
This is in Proctor.
In Proctor, and built by a very wealthy patron who wanted to recreate a European castle in Vermont. And it's got brick and stone and murals on the ceilings, and it's really over the top.
Over the top.
But not your typical Vermont building.
Go to Proctor and check it out, the Wilson Castle. Britta Ton, let me ask you, because, you know, we've been talking a lot about the history of architecture here, but of course, this is always changing, and we're going to be moving ahead into the 21st century. I mean, are you sensing any changes to come, signs that we're seeing changes already in Vermont architecture, maybe even based on things like conservation and renewables and that kind of thing?
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I would say, is that when you think about what are the trends that are really going to last into the future and maybe 50 years from now, what are we going to look back on and see was really defining about this era? And I think in an era of climate change and more concern about using renewable sources of materials, maybe using more local materials, we are already seeing that in architecture. And sometimes it's as much as using a local material to just add a little bit of ornamentation to a new building. But it's also just thinking about sustainability. So many buildings now are going through LEED or Green Globe certification. It's even now a requirement of some cities and towns to have new buildings meet one of these sustainable requirements. And, you know, there's also concerns with floodplains and whether, you know, where are we going to build our buildings going forward? Are they going to be more elevated? And I think we might look back 50 years from now and see, you know, the net zero house or the zero energy house is going to be way more popular in the near future.
But we can still make them look good, right?
Sure. I strongly believe that.
We're going to certainly hope so. We've got Kevin on the line from Montpelier. Hi, Kevin. How you doing?
Hi. I have a question about why so many buildings are rectangular in terms of their footprint as opposed to being square, given that a square is a more efficient shape in terms of maximizing the square footage and minimizing the amount of material.
Interesting question. So rectangular versus square, what are thoughts on that?
That's a good question. I would say it's – I don't know that there's a specific reason for one over the other. Beyond, you know, the general layout and footprint of the building and the interior plan, the rectangular houses early on would typically have a central bay with a massive chimney and hearth, and then a room on each side that could be heated by that central chimney. So if you have a rectangle, that's easier to do than a square where you might have a hearth in the middle that has to heat rooms on all sides of it. Then the hearth would take up the whole house. So practicality early on. Later, we do see a transition from the rectangular federal style into the more square footprint of the Italianate. And then once the Victorian period comes along with dimensional lumber, then we start to see all these crazy footprints with towers and bay windows and really breaking away from that mold of the square or rectangular footprint.
Let me throw this question out to both of you. We'll start with you, Britta. Is there such a thing as bad architecture? And I'm not talking about, you know, forgetting to put in a load-bearing wall or something, but and I know this is subjective, but still.
Very subjective. I mean, I can find a way to appreciate just about everything. Maybe there's some 1970s buildings that are...
I'm just thinking about baseball stadiums built in the 70s, which are some of the ugliest concrete bowls you've ever seen.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm going to take this opportunity to quickly mention one style, which when it came out was really kind of derided, but called the octagon mode in the 1840s, 1850s. This guy, Orson Fowler, he was actually a phrenologist and an amateur architect. He wrote a book about the octagon house, A Home for All, and he was so passionate about it, the idea that an octagonally shaped house would be the best shape of a house because it was more efficient to heat and cool. You use less materials. There's no dark corners. And people did not like it. There are about 2,000 surviving. And we have a handful of them in Vermont. There's one.
We do.
Yeah, just a few. There's one in St. Johnsbury, the Wilmington Roundhouse, built in the 1840s. Many times they were just left to kind of decay and were torn down. Actually, Fowler's own house, which was really derided in New York, was torn down in 1898 after not even 50 years of being of standing. So,
very briefly, Devin, there was a style called brutalism. Is that right?
Yes.
That sounds terrible.
Oh, it's wonderful. You will learn to love it. Trust me.
I love it.
The name notwithstanding, it's now actually we're trying to rebrand it.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree with that.
As heroic architecture. And this is the architecture of the 60s and 70s. You can see some examples at UVM on the campus of the use of concrete and glass. Yeah. And these massive Boston City Hall is a great example. Mm. And very, very thoughtful buildings, but they can be tough to kind of wrap your head around if what you're expecting a historic building to look like is Queen Anne or colonial.
And again, we have these ideas in our head,
right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Go to UVM and check out some of the brutalism or heroic architecture, as we would call it. We've got about a minute left here, and I want to ask you both if there are any guidebooks or other books you might want to recommend for people interested in, you know, viewing and learning more about Vermont's architectural history.
Certainly the Architecture of Vermont book by Glenn Andrus and Curtis Johnson that came out in 2014, I believe, is the overview of Vermont architecture. And then a lot of historical societies, local organizations, have put together walking tours and guidebooks to architecture in their specific communities. Fun, so yeah. Definitely check those out.
And Britta, any recommendations for reading?
I would say A Field Guide to American Architecture by Virginia Lee McAllister just gives you a really nice overview of every style. It's not specific to Vermont, but it has lots of pictures and lots of drawings. So it's really visual, so you can really kind of compare what you're seeing in the picture and the drawing to what you're seeing out.
Devin Coleman is the State Architectural Historian for the Vermont Division for Historic Preservation. Devin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. This is great.
And Britta Ton is an architectural historian and preservation planner at engineering and design firm VHB in South Burlington. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks so much.